The United Nations fight on a battlefront which stretches across the world. For free men everywhere, London now broadcasts the news of that fight for world freedom.
This is London calling. Here is the news read by Jack Morrison. The fall of Tobruk has now been confirmed in London. Messages from the desert indicate that the enemy massed his forces for the attack on a small front after dive bombers had prepared the way. Tonight's Moscow communique admits that a wedge has been driven into the defenses of Sevastopol. There is news of guerrilla resistance in the Netherlands East Indies. Late tonight, London confirmed that Tobruk had fallen. The announcement was foreshadowed in the midday Cairo communique, which said that the enemy, attacking in great strength yesterday, had broken through the defenses in the face of the most determined resistance and occupied a considerable area inside them. Later messages from Cairo stressed the gravity of the situation in the fortress. The enemy's main blow against the southeast of the perimeter was preceded by dive bomber attacks. Then the enemy's infantry and tanks were hurled in overwhelming strength against the defenders. It was the favorite German plan of concentrating his attack on a narrow sector. The British newspapers frankly admit the seriousness of the reverse, with the loss of many experienced soldiers and much valuable material. The London Times says it is the culmination of setbacks in Libya for which few had been prepared, pointing out that Tobruk is out of reach of fighter support from aerodromes behind the Egyptian frontier. The Times suggests that the sector of surprise may have come from what Rome has called mass formations of German and Italian aircraft. There's no disposition to underestimate the new danger. The newspapers are unanimous in insisting that counteraction must be drastic and swift to remedy the Eighth Army's disadvantage in equipment and to halt and throw back the enemy on the long and difficult road to Egypt. The Daily Mail says that the sending of supplies and reinforcements will impose an additional strain on our shipping and regards the loss of Tobruk as another proof that the building of more ships and the reduction in losses are our greatest needs at this stage. Tobruk has a special place in the affections of the British public, but as the Daily Herald points out, the people's reaction to the news will be one of determination, not of depression. Every citizen will be eager to play his part in yet sterner endeavors. In the dispatch received tonight, our observer Richard Dimbleby emphasizes the speed with which the attack on Tobruk came. He quotes an official observer inside the fortress who said in a report that there hadn't been much opportunity this time for the troops there to arrange themselves to the best advantage. Dimbleby, who recorded his dispatch during the fighting yesterday morning, says it looked as though the enemy had assembled in one striking force all the tanks and infantry that could be collected in the area. After the dive bombers had pounded our forward posts on the perimeter, the enemy infantry, according to Dimbleby, attacked at two points in a small area in order to open bridgeheads for their tanks. The attackers included Lorikon infantry of the 15th Panzer Division, part of the German 90th Light Division, and Italians of the Trieste Division. British and Indian troops fighting side by side with great gallantry took the first shock of the attack. An agency message says that the Axis command decided to attack along the corridor towards Ed Duda, waiting only 2 days after the troops had been isolated. The main forces were massed for the attack, while patrols were out to guard against any flank attack. In addition to striking from the east, the agency correspondent says the enemy moved up heavy artillery south of Tobruk to support his striking force. Back on the Saloon escarpment yesterday, Dimbleby saw our guns wreck enemy armored cars moving along the ruins of Capuzzo. They were part of the enemy force, including motorized infantry in some strength, that advanced towards the frontier simultaneously with the attack on Tobruk. Dimbleby describes this move not as an attack on our positions, but rather as if the enemy had stretched out an arm to hold us aside while he attacked Tobruk. This news bulletin comes to you from London. The Russians say tonight that at a tremendous cost in killed and wounded, the Germans have driven a wedge into the defenses of Sevastopol. The official communique doesn't indicate where this wedge is. The Germans have been claiming big successes on the northern side of the city for several days, but Paul Winterton, in a special cable to the BBC from Moscow, mentions a withdrawal south of the city where the Germans have admitted Russian counterattacks. The Russians have taken up intermediary defense posts, and Winterton described the situation as extremely serious for our allies. The Russian newspaper Izvestia says the enemy broke into the defenses after the terrific artillery and air bombardment. Then they sent infantry units forward, which were mown down by the Soviet gunners. The second attack was made on the following day, and this brought the enemy into the defense line. Moscow radio has told how one Russian battery stood up to a barrage of over 1,000 shells in one day, but continued to return the fire before the enemy troops were thrown back. The Black Sea fleet is giving the hard-pressed defenders all possible support, and cruisers and destroyers are shelling the enemy. Marines have been landed to reinforce the garrison. Winterton says there is no sign of any slackening of the German onslaught, even though 5 German and 2 Romanian infantry divisions have already been cut to pieces. The enemy is still bringing up reinforcements, and some 500 planes are being used in concentrated bombing attacks on the city. The supplement to the Soviet communique gives news of a German attack that was repulsed on a sector in the Kharkov region. In spite of heavy losses, the Germans succeeded in crossing a river and pressing the Russians back. But our allies immediately counterattacked, regained the west bank of the river, and captured a number of positions. Winterton, in his dispatch, says that there is some very fierce fighting on this front. But, he says, the Germans are making little or no progress, and the Russians are counterattacking powerfully in places. Berlin radio claims that the Luftwaffe has raided Rostov, the great industrial city 13 miles from the mouth of the River Don. The news that a Japanese submarine had shelled a telegraph station on Vancouver Island was announced in Ottawa tonight by Colonel Ralston, the Canadian Defense Minister. He said that the shelling took place yesterday, but no damage was done. Other news of operations in the Northern Pacific comes from Washington, where it was stated tonight that the Japanese had occupied the island of Kiska, 700 miles off the Alaskan mainland. United States bombers have taken advantage of the improved weather of the past few days to attack enemy objectives on the island. Hits are reported on a cruiser, and a transport has been sunk. This is London calling. In China, the Japanese are meeting with strong opposition on the outskirts of Kuangfeng in their drive south into Fujian province. Chongqing also announces tonight a Chinese attack on the mountain passes along the railway line between Peking and Hankou. The communique just received from Allied headquarters in the Southwest Pacific reports limited reconnaissance activities by both sides in all areas. A special communique from the Netherlands East Indies authorities in the Southwest Pacific reports a secret visit to Australia of a high Dutch army officer who is the leader of guerrilla units carrying on the fight in the Dutch East Indies. The officer has now returned to his command. The communique says that incessant underground warfare continues against the Japanese invaders and that the guerrillas have ample supplies and methods of replenishing them. And that is the end of the news from London.